Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we are going to be talking about your weight this hour. I know this is a billion-dollar industry. There are so many people who made a New Year's resolution to lose some pounds, and maybe you made the same resolution last year or the year before, 5 years ago, or even 10 years ago, and you're very motivated to lose weight, and many of you perhaps lost some weight last year or the year before, and then you regain the weight. So what in the world is going on here? Why do pounds often return? Our guest this hour, Tara Parker Pope, wrote a fascinating piece in the New York Times Sunday magazine a week ago, and she has been very much in demand as a speaker on this topic because so many Americans have made eating healthier or losing weight part of their New Year's resolution. She says in the article that she's always felt perplexed about her inability to keep weight off. She knows the medical benefits of weight loss. I mean, look what she does for a living. She doesn't drink sugary sodas or eat fast food. She exercises regularly. A few years ago, she even completed a marathon. And yet during the 23 years since graduating from college, she's lost 10 or 20 pounds at a time, maintained it for a little while, and then gained it all back and more to the point where she says she is now, although maybe this is different because the article was a couple weeks ago, easily 60 pounds overweight. But she can run a marathon too, so does she need to worry about this? Well, we're going to talk about this. Tara Parker Pope is the creator and writer of Well, which is a daily health blog and weekly column for the New York Times. And she is joining us from the studios of the Classical Network, WWFM, in Princeton, New Jersey. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I know we are going to get a ton of phone calls this hour. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Tara, thank you so much for being with us. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. You start your article, I wonder how you found this guy, maybe you've been there to talk to him, with this director of a weight loss clinic in Australia who did a very interesting study. Please tell us.
Yeah, Dr. Proietta's group, he's in Melbourne, and no, I didn't actually travel to Australia, but this was a very important study. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It had a lot of credibility. And what he found is what a lot of people have believed, but it really hasn't been shown yet the way that he showed it, is that long after dieting stops, our bodies continue to fight against the weight loss. So you can lose weight, you can stop dieting, and you can adopt a very healthy lifestyle. And slowly but surely, the weight seems to come back for most people. In fact, you know, studies show that 80 to 95% of dieters do not succeed and do regain all the lost weight.
Oh my gosh, that's a huge number.
It's called a failure rate or a recidivism rate. And I think it's a really important message because so much of the diet industry, you know, is telling us that, well, it's easy, anybody can do it, you just have to believe. That's a new set of commercials out right now. And it's so much more complex than that. Human biology is so much more complex than that. This goes so far beyond willpower and the desire to be healthy and fit. There's so much going on in our bodies. And I think what this study showed, what was so fascinating about this particular study, is that a year after the weight loss had stopped, these people were in weight maintenance mode, doing their best to just stay at the same weight. And they were highly motivated people to do this, and they were getting a lot of help, you know, regular nutrition counseling, you know, more than most of us get when we're trying to maintain our weight. And yet the weight was just slowly creeping back for these people. But you know, blood work showed and all kinds of other tests that they do in these kinds of studies that there was just a whole cocktail of hormones that are related to hunger and fat regulation. And those were all completely out of whack. You know, a hormone called ghrelin that makes you hungry was, you know, very high, much higher than it should have been. A hormone called leptin was much lower than it should have been. It was an indicator that the body was really just, it was a backlash, a biological backlash to get the weight back on. And our bodies like to keep the fat. They like fat, and that's why it's so hard for us to lose it.
And does this go way, way back when we needed fat through the winter? Because you would think that the body would realize, hey, this is a pretty good thing. I feel a little bit better because I've lost some of this weight. You got to ask, why in the world would the body want to fight against something that's good for you?
Well, you know, this is the theory that the ability to store fat is an adaptive strategy, and that in time of famine, you know, if everyone around you is starving and you have a baby, the fact that your body can store its fat allows you to keep nursing your baby, for instance, or continue the pregnancy. So there's all kinds of reasons why this is a good thing under certain circumstances. But, you know, our bodies, you know, evolved in a completely different set of circumstances than what we live in today, where food is so plentiful. And a lot of people say to me, well, genes haven't changed in the past few years. No, our genes are the same. What's different is the environment. And what we're seeing is that when you are, you know, when food is so plentiful, when even small portions of food are very energy dense, meaning they have a lot of calories per bite, it doesn't take very much for this adaptive strategy to become a negative and for it to manifest itself as obesity. We don't really have a mechanism for coping with times of abundance. We didn't evolve that way. So that's why it's very easy for the body to become fat and stay fat.
Mm-hmm. And you talk in the article, and I think that this is true even when you're dieting. I don't diet a lot because I like to eat too much,
actually.
That's
a good thing. You shouldn't diet a lot.
I like to eat. But
dieting is not a good thing, so don't do it if you can help it.
If you think about dieting, though, what you're thinking about all the time is all the food that you're not having a chance to eat. It's just, it becomes sort of, it fills your head, doesn't it?
Well, what's interesting is, yeah, clearly there's a psychological component. And there are some research to show that once people start dieting, that in itself triggers, you know, binge eating behavior. And it may explain why so many people diet, lose weight, and then gain back the weight and more, because there is some psychological response. But what's really fascinating about the brain and weight loss, they've done brain scan studies where they have looked at dieters before and after losing weight and in the weight maintenance mode. And what they see is that the parts of the brain that are related to desire and to reward are more activated when seeing food after a diet, in the maintenance phase, long after the maintenance phase, than before dieting. So the brain is getting more excited by food, and the parts of the brain related to restraint, to willpower, to, you know, the resolve not to eat, that part of the brain is less activated. So it's really this perfect storm where, you know, there is something is happening in the body, and when the body loses fat, there's all kinds of signals that are sent out, and one of those signals affects the brain, and the brain is saying, you know, the brain is really trying to find every way it can to get the body to reclaim its fat.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you're obsessed with food and you're thinking about food and you don't have any willpower. It's not necessarily that, you know, you lack the character, the strength of character to do this. This is your body working against you for, you know, very scientific, you know, well-explained reasons. It's not really a personal failing.
And I don't know how common this is, but you mentioned your mother in the article, and this seemed to me to be a lot of variation in weight, that your mother's weight probably fluctuated between 150 and 250 pounds. There's a great variation in that. Why was that the case as you look back on your mom?
My memory of growing up, and this is where the study of weight and weight in families is so complicated, because we learn behaviors and we also inherit tendencies, you know, genetic tendencies, and sorting out what's what can be difficult. But in that situation, I think it's not uncommon. I've heard from lots of people who have done this themselves or have family members who've done it. You know, maybe you weigh 150 pounds and you want to get down to 140, so you diet, and then the backlash hits and you get up to 160. And then over the course of the years, you go up and down. I remember one period of my mother had gone to a medical weight loss center and had lost about 80 pounds and looked really great. And she was working very, very hard on the maintenance and going to regular counseling and working with her doctors. And then we had some kind of family emergency involving one of my siblings, and it was a medical crisis, and my mother, you know, couldn't be as vigilant because she was tending to a sibling and, you know, to her child, which was completely understandable. And the moment that her focus was off you know, this constant maintenance, the weight just came back, and she became incredibly discouraged. And I do think people in this situation, they have moments where they give up, where they overeat. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but, you know, they are being bombarded with biological signals to eat, eat, eat. And we expect them to be superhuman and resist those signals. Thin people who are naturally thin, who've never struggled with weight, or people who, you know, exercise a lot and eat well and don't have a weight issue that, you know, an obvious weight issue, they can be very judgmental sometimes and
yes.
say, well, I do it. But just the fact that you can maintain your weight and that it works for you doesn't mean you have the same set of rules that a person who may have inherited a tendency to be overweight, a person that may have dieted and may have this sort of weight-reduced state that is very metabolically different than another person. I mean, there's so much change that happens in the body, to the muscles, to the brain, to the gastric hormones. Once you've lost weight, you're different. Your body is different, and the rule book is different. And I think that's the message of the story and what so many people don't understand, and they blame themselves, and they don't understand that biology is working against them very strongly.
You write about some people. I can't believe people have time to do this or can do it, who exercise, who are overweight, and are exercising 2 hours a day.
It's true, and there is a registry of about 10,000 people who have maintained weight loss. To join the registry, I think you have to have only lost about 30 pounds and kept it off for 3 years. But most of the people in this registry have lost about 70 pounds, I think, is the average. So some people have very high weight loss, and they've maintained it, I think, for 6 or 7 years. So these are very successful weight losers. It's a fraction of the people that have tried to lose weight. It's a tiny percentage. 10,000 sounds like an impressive number, but when you consider that, you know, 30, 40 million people have tried to lose weight, that it's a tiny percentage. But what's interesting and what's really consistent about these people is that they really never stop thinking about careful eating and exercise. And on average, people in this registry walk, they exercise the equivalent of a daily 4 mile walk. So it's as if everybody walked 4 miles a day in the country, you know, we wouldn't have a weight problem. But these people, so that's the average is a 4 mile walk. But everybody I talk to is well above that. The people who've maintained 100, 130 pound weight losses.
Ooh.
There, you know, it is about 2 hours a day. I talk to a man who bicycles 2 hours a day. I talk to a woman who, what's interesting is they really, you know, she weighs every day. She measures and weighs her food. She's very careful. She writes it down. She's accountable every night. She looks at what she's eaten. It's constantly, she doesn't like it, but you know what? If she had cancer, if she had diabetes, if she had high blood pressure, you would understand why she was taking charge of her health. So I don't think we should be, some people have said, well, this sounds like disordered eating. I don't think so. I think this is a woman who has really appreciated that she needs to be very vigilant about her health. But this woman does exercise about 2 hours a day. She rides her bike. She does water aerobics. She is very careful about counting the calories. And her goal is, you know, a certain number of calories of exercise a day. So she does what she needs to achieve that. It might be hopping on the bike and zipping to the post office. And that might be 15 minutes of exercise. So she doesn't necessarily do it 2 hours at once, but she makes sure that she documents 2 hours of extra vigorous physical activity.
And when you use the word weight maintenance, and when you look at that woman and others like her, is that something that you just have to do for the rest of your life? Do people know that? And, whoa, that would be a huge discouragement to me to want to have to live that way forever.
Well, I don't think it's discouraging, but yes, the woman I'm talking about, her name is Janice Bridge, and she lives in Davis, California. She's a wonderful woman, and what's important about this woman is she's not rail thin. She doesn't weigh 120 pounds. She weighs 195 pounds, and this is what she has to do to maintain a weight of 195 pounds on a 5'8 body. She looks terrific, but she's not a runway model. She's happy, she's active, and she's healthy, which is what matters. But at one point, she was 330 pounds. So she's trying to maintain 130-pound weight loss. And, you know, I was worried in writing this article, would this be discouraging to people? You know, I don't think we do anybody any favor by saying this is easy and that if once you lose the weight, you're done. Because once you lose the weight is when the hard work starts. And I think I've learned that personally over the years. And for me, it was a conversation with one of these weight loss experts. I was doing a totally different story, but we started talking about some of his experiments, his mice experiments, his human studies, and everything. And for me, it just clicked, and I started to understand my own experience so well, and why during times of weight loss, when I was being physically active, enough, I thought, and eating well, eating the right way, I thought, I was still gaining weight, even though I looked around me and I was being so much more healthy than many people around me. But, you know, he has pioneered a lot of the research on the metabolic changes that happen after weight loss. And people who lose weight are at a real disadvantage. I mean, their muscles don't, they're more efficient. They don't burn as many calories when they go on a, you can go on a brisk walk and you're burning, you know, 50, 60 calories less than the person next to you. So it's a real disadvantage once you've lost weight because your body has changed.
And does that change if you keep the weight off for a longer period of time, that metabolic change?
Right. There's no, unfortunately, there's no indication that it does. So that's where we get into this issue of, is it discouraging? And it is a lifetime commitment. And it is a lifetime commitment.
Yes.
The Proietto study found the change existed for a year after weight loss. But Columbia has done some research. They've really pioneered Columbia University in New York. A lot of what we know about this, and they've got data from 1 to 6 years suggesting, they're small studies, but it strongly suggests that the effect is just as strong at 6 years as it is at 6 months, that your body is still in that sort of frenzied quest to reclaim its fat. It doesn't let up. And so that's why you can't let up. And while that may sound daunting, I think what people who have done this find is that they're, at least they know the rules. Now they know what they're up against. Yes, it's going to require this constant vigilance. It's not going to be easy. It's like they're not going to be like everybody. I think that's your goal when you're trying to lose weight. I just want to be like everybody else. You know, I just want to weigh 140 pounds and look okay in my clothes, and maybe I'll be a size 10, and I won't be skinny, but I want to be able to just enjoy life and not worry about food. It's just, that's not the body you have. You know, that's not what you've, that's not the cards that you, those are not the right cards you've been dealt. And I think we all have our own challenges, but I think once you accept that you have a condition, that this is who you are, I think then it's easier to move forward from that and decide, do I want to just take care of the body I have and be happy and comfortable in my body, which I think is an excellent strategy to just be as healthy as you can be.
Right.
Or do you want to try to lose weight and try to take this on? And I think there's a range of choices in there.
Let's go to phone calls. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Tara Parker Pope is our guest. She's author of a piece that appeared in the December 28. It was the cover story of the New York Times Magazine, The Fat Trap. I'm Kathleen Dunn, to you in just a moment, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Ralph Nader will join us. He has a new book, Getting Steamed to Overcome Corporatism, Build It Together to Win. Let's go to phone calls for Tara Parker Pope, and we start with Wayne in Green Bay. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. About 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, excuse me, I lost about 80 pounds. And I could almost pinpoint the day that a change took place from losing weight to starting to gain the weight back. It's like something happened in my head that stopped the weight loss. Almost immediately, I gained 10 pounds back. And I was working out 2 hours a day, 6 days a week. And I was able to maintain that 10 pounds off until my wife and I started a business, and then I couldn't exercise anymore. I have now gained about 40 of those pounds back and have been maintaining at that 40 pounds. But the hardest thing I ever did in my life was try to lose that weight and try and keep it off.
Tara.
I think this is a... I mean, the good news is that you did manage the 40-pound weight loss, and you should be, you know, that's a tremendous achievement, and I think we should celebrate these small weight losses because you're bucking the environment, biology, you know, evolution. So it is a great achievement, and I think it's interesting because, you know, I believe that you were exercising that much and eating that well, and I think that what we don't realize is that weight gain tends to be a very small mistake. It's not a mistake of massive binge eating. It's a mistake of 100 calories a day, maybe. And so when we take our, you know, eye off the ball, that's why we, you know, it's so easy to regain the weight back if we get a distraction like, you know, work, getting busy, or maybe a death in the family or a sick family member. It's a really common story.
And I think the other thing is I'm now over 60 years old, the older I get, the less I eat, but it still doesn't seem to help matters any.
It's definitely true. You know, it was interesting when I was doing this story because I was comparing the weights of a 66-year-old woman versus a woman in her 30s, and I was amazed at how many fewer calories the older woman was allowed. So our bodies really do slow down, and it does get much more difficult as we gain weight. I do think the focus as we age, I think the question you have to ask yourself is, you know, am I comfortable? Am I taking care of my body? Am I trying my best to exercise? If you can't do the 2 hours a day, can you get in, you know, 45 minutes 3 or 4 days a week? That's not going to be enough necessarily to, you know, help you lose weight and keep it off, but it might be, you know, we know it's enough to help your heart to, you know, people who exercise that much have much better long-term outcomes and much better health. So I think we need to start as a country putting more value on weight maintenance, on taking care of the bodies that we have. Some people will be able to achieve weight loss. I mean, you've achieved a 40-pound weight loss, and I hope that you can maintain it, and that might work for you. A lot of people I interviewed who had weight problems lost weight, often gained back about 30 pounds, 40 pounds before they were able to hit maintenance. So there is a definite pattern of people gaining a portion of the weight back and then finding kind of a point of equilibrium where it works for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't have to exercise 2 hours a day to make your heart healthy, do you? Or to, I mean, that,
no.
Who, nobody can do that.
Well, that's my point. I mean, if you're exercising 30 minutes a day,
right.
You know, if you're moderately active, you're doing better than most people. I mean, I think the key with health is to not be sedentary. You know, there's a whole field, really interesting field of inactivity research right now of just what inactivity does to you. And it's very bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's much better to be, not I think, I know based on the science, that to be fit and fat, to be a fat person who is active is better than to be a thin person who doesn't do anything.
Right.
And there are a lot of thin people who will tell you, I never exercise. You know, I eat what I want, I never exercise. So that's their body, but they're not really doing any of the positive things for themselves, and they're probably hurting themselves. So this inactivity is becoming a really important risk factor for poor health.
What about these studies that have come out recently of mice, I think maybe beyond mice, that have shown that really low-calorie diets are going to allow you to live a longer life? In other words, you know, the skinnier you can be, the better for old age.
Yeah, that is an interesting field of research at this super restricted eating, and they do have some ongoing studies of human beings and animals. You know, I don't think we know how much longer, if any, of these people are going to live than the rest of us. The truth is that most people can't sustain that. I don't think it's a practical solution. It's not any more practical than saying everybody should have bariatric surgery. I mean, most of us live in between those extremes, and, you know, super restrictive eating just would not work for most people. So yeah, there is some evidence in animal studies, and they're studying it in humans, but I don't think we really fully understand what that's about. It may not be, you know, is the very low weight what's healthy? It's a little confusing because there have been data published by JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and others, showing that the healthiest people tend to be the overweight, not the obese and not the average weight and not the underweight, that the slightly overweight tend to live longer.
Really?
A little longer.
Huh.
Yeah, the average weight people are really close, so I don't think we can say that you should gain a few pounds to get the benefit. But being average weight or a little overweight is actually, you know, in terms of longevity, is a good thing. Being obese is not good for you, but at the same time, I think about 30% of the obese are considered fit. Fitness is what really counts more than weight, and the underweight are in a lot of trouble. So the very thin people have the worst outcomes. I would say maybe the very thin and the morbidly obese. But the spectrum of average weight to overweight to obese, you'd be surprised within that. It's not that being obese, you know, guarantees. There are obese people who have low blood pressure, you know, their insulin response is fine. They're fit. They've got a low resting heart rate. You know, low, you know, they've got all the right, you know, low cholesterol, all the right indicators. So you can be fit and fat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in that group for sure. I know this because I have very low, you know, I've got very good low blood pressure. I've got very low cholesterol.
Wonderful.
I've actually had a coronary artery heart scan that looks at, you know, your heart risk. And why I've had that is sort of a silly story, but I did have one because I was curious about it. And, you know, I don't have heart disease. I've got like a zero on that. So a lot of people have asked, well, how do you know that you're in such good health? Well, I actually do know. So my goal is to just maintain that state and to just, I love exercise. I want to keep exercising. I hope that it changes the scale at some point, but if it doesn't, I'm probably okay with that because you get so much from exercise. You get a community of, you know, when you run a marathon, it's a blast. You're hanging out with a lot of fun people. It is a lot of, people don't tell you it's fun. I'm telling you, the people who are running 3 and 4 hour marathons are not having fun. But people like me who are running, you know, 6, 6.5 hours, we're having a good time.
We're having fun.
A very good time at the back of the pack.
I can't imagine that, Tara, but I'm glad you're having fun. I couldn't do that, but I do swim, and you know, not as much as I should, but it is true. If you don't do it, you feel like this slug, kind of. If you don't move, the body just wants to take a nap.
You know, it's funny.
A lot.
After I exercise, I feel very light on my feet. I feel like I've lost weight, even though the scale hasn't moved.
Right.
I feel very
right.
energetic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and peppy, and it's a great feeling. I really feel that way after I do. Sometimes I do Bikram yoga, which is like a 90-minute yoga class in a very hot room. Some people hate it, but I love it. And after that class, I feel like I've actually never used any illegal substance, but I have to say I feel really great. And I often say, I wonder if this is what it feels like, because I'm so up. I'm so high on the endorphins and how great the exercise feels. So to achieve that feeling through exercise, you know, I think people who are overweight need to just appreciate that exercise is not about being skinny. Exercise is about just feeling really good inside your body.
Kyle in Madison. Hi, Kyle.
Hi. From birth to death, for centuries, we were hunters and gatherers. 80 years old, and you are out hunting and gathering. That means exercising, something that it's beneath most people. You're not living life if you don't exercise, and our guest today is doing drugs. She's getting high on a naturally body's natural production of the only real drug we need for anything. It's called endorphins. And you exercise, you get a free benefit. You get naturally high with no hangover. No, the only addictive part is it feels so good, you want to do it again tomorrow. And you'll never lose weight if you think you're just going to control your diet and not exercise, because for centuries we've genetically engineered ourselves to be endurance athletes, you know, in a very subtle way. A long distance walking of 8 hours or 10 hours gathering, there's your weight loss, there's your calorie burning. You can never lose weight if you ingest more calories than you burn in the day.
I do have a thought. I mean, I think, one, it's not practical to think that anybody in this day and age has 8 hours to give to exercise. Most people don't even have an hour or two. And I certainly understand people who have two jobs. Maybe they work a night shift and they take care of their kids in the day. They have an aging, you know, parent that they're caring for. Not everybody can fit ridiculous amounts of exercise into their day. It really is a luxury and a privilege. And there are lots of people who really, despite maybe best efforts, can't do that. This idea that, you know, we're meant to exercise constantly and that if you just only exercise, you'll lose weight. They've done some really interesting research where they've put people in a very controlled laboratory setting, and they have had them, you know, they've known exactly what they've eaten. They've put them on the treadmill. They've monitored the heart rate, and they have found really convincingly that exercise alone does not lead to weight loss. It doesn't. But what we do know is that exercise does improve your health, and we know that people who are trying to maintain a weight loss, exercise essentially corrects for the eating mistakes that we make, and that's why it's helpful to maintaining weight loss. But most people don't lose weight by exercise alone. It really doesn't happen. So I think it's just important to have that perspective, because we all have a varying response. I mean, once a person has lost, you know, it's one thing to say eat less, move more, but how much less and how much more? A person who weighs 140 pounds naturally compared to a person who weighs 140 pounds because they lost 60 pounds to get there, they dieted to get there, they're very different. The person who dieted to get to that weight is at a 300 to 400 calorie disadvantage. So That's a lot of calories. And that's what the research shows. So it's really not simple. The math is different for a person who has lost weight. The rule book is different, and that's why that person is struggling so much, because they're looking at other people and saying, I'm eating less than them, but I'm still gaining weight. I'm exercising more than them, but it's not working for me. And that's because the numbers are, you know, your disadvantage is much greater. So I think we need to have that sort of understanding when we make comments like eat less, move more, it's simple. It's really not simple. It's the body, the human body is this incredibly complex machine, and we have such variation in how we respond to food and exercise, and our genetics play a role. There's some studies that show people with certain genetic predispositions among they look at children and they give them opportunities to eat food, and they find that they all eat the same amount of food, but children with a certain genetic variation that's linked with obesity, those kids aren't picking out, but they're attracted and drawn to the foods that have more calories per bite. So they end up eating more calories even though they're not being gluttonous. There are studies of twins where they find that they can put a dozen sets of twins in a study, a very controlled environment. They can control the exercise. They can control the food. They overfeed these twins, and they should gain about 24 pounds during the course of the study. Some of the twins only gain 10 pounds, while other twins gain 30 pounds. So even among those groups, you're feeding them the exact same amount. They're getting the same exercise. There's consistency by heredity. So the brothers are gaining about the same amount of weight. But if you look at different sets, you see a different reaction to food. So there's so much individual variation. We have to be so careful not to make these blanket statements that all you got to do is exercise. Right. That's not true.
Thanks, Kyle. Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. I realize you're talking about the body from the inside out, and it's very interesting. I'm wondering, however, if there are foods that people who are dieting are being encouraged to eat that are part of the problem. And I'm talking about whole grains. People are encouraged all the time to eat whole grains, whole wheat, whole rye, you know, barley. I read a study, I wish I had it in front of me, in which gluten was causing people to gain great amounts of belly fat. I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with that. And who decides what a person's perfect weight is?
Well, I definitely agree with the last comment. I mean, I think that for me, my best weight is a weight at which I'm comfortable, which I can, you know, enjoy my life, and I feel just, you know, good in my skin, and I can exercise easily. I'm heavier than that weight right now. I had an ankle injury, and I gained weight when I stopped exercising for a little while, and I'm trying to get back to a more comfortable weight. I don't have the goal to be a size 4 by any stretch. That's not my goal. But there is a weight for me that feels comfortable, and I think we should all decide that for ourselves and stop looking at the medical charts. As far as what you're talking about with wheat and gluten, it sounds like you're talking about a new book called Wheat Belly. Is that the one? It's an interesting book, and it's gotten a lot of attention. And gluten in general, you know, people who have an intolerance or a celiac disease do have a problem with this. And I think there's a theory now that maybe more people have a sensitivity to this than previously believed. It's a theory right now. I think the science is evolving. But what is consistent when you talk to people who have successfully lost weight is they do consistently say that sugars and white carbs and processed foods, you know, white pasta, white bread, that kind of thing. One woman called them her gateway drugs to overeating. I think a lot of people find that maybe they're and there's some evidence with the glycemic index that when you eat white, you know, potatoes, white starchy foods, that you get hungry sooner, you get a glucose response. So there's a whole body of science that I think some people do have a problem with these individual foods, but again, there's so much individual variation. I don't think we can say, well, it would be terrific if we could identify this one thing as the reason we're fat and that we have a hard time losing weight, but there's really not a simple single explanation.
Yeah, it might be an interesting experiment for people. Some of the people who have called in who've had trouble maintaining a weight loss, try a month without, you know, whole grains. Brown rice is great. You know, look at the foods that have gluten in them. Try to avoid those for a month. It would just be rather interesting, I think.
Can I tell you something? Gluten-free eating is incredibly difficult to achieve because everything's got gluten in it.
Right.
I've talked with people who have celiac, and that is a really big challenge. But I would bet also that many people who have weight problems have tried pretty much everything. You know, that's one pattern that you see. So I agree that, I mean, I think, you know, cutting out sugar and white carbs is probably a good idea for a lot of reasons, because you're going to be eliminating processed foods. I think the simple advice for most people that works is to try to, you know, just eat real food. Michael Pollan talks about this, you know, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And I think it's really simple, elegant advice that if we are sticking with just whole vegetables, you know, simple home-cooked food, not too fancy, and staying away from foods and packages and foods that you get served through a window, I think that's all very smart advice. It may not help you lose a lot of weight, but it's going to help your body. You're going to be healthier.
Thank you very much, Marty, for the call. What about studies that may have been done on gradual weight loss? Does that make a difference, Tara, if you are, your goal is, I'm going to lose 3 pounds this year rather than, and I'm sure this is the way most people do not diet, they want immediate results. They want a month from now, 10 pounds down, or want to lose it right away to see the difference. Does it make a difference in terms of regaining weight?
Well, this is a big question, and this is a really frequent question I've gotten since the article, because a lot of the research, just for pure time reasons, folk uses very rapid weight loss to conduct the studies because, you know, you've only got funding for 2 years, so you can't really do the 3 pounds a year route. I would also argue that 3 pounds a year is too slow, because your body weight is going to vary within, you know, five or eight pounds on any, you know, given, you know, I don't know what the variation is, but there's a lot of variation, and the 3 pounds is too kind of narrow of a slice of this. So, but say we're talking about a pound a week or a half a pound a week, you know, something small like that. There are many people who swear by slow weight loss, and partly the reason is that you are slowly relearning good habits, and I think this is the strategy of Weight Watchers. You know, you're writing down your food, you're very accountable, you're counting points, and you're losing weight at a reasonable pace, and over time, if you can be committed to this way of living, then you kind of, you're teaching yourself along the way. So by the time you're at your desired weight, at your goal, you've already learned those good habits that maybe you wouldn't have learned if you'd done 10 weeks on a liquid diet. So I certainly understand that from the psychology of that. Right now, the research doesn't suggest that there's really any difference, that your body is more likely to let you stay at a lower weight if you lose it slow than fast. The body is responding to the level of fat you have. It doesn't really care how you got there. So, you know, we see this with rapid weight loss and slow weight loss. You know, they've done studies of, there was a study in Israel of a low-fat diet, a Mediterranean diet, and a low-carb Atkins-style diet. And at the end of 2 years, you know, people had, you know, gotten, there's two studies, and I might get them confused, but depending on the study, you know, at the end of the period, the weight loss was about 10 pounds, but at year one, they'd lost about 20 pounds, but by the time the study was over at the year two, they'd regained about half of it, and that was on slow weight loss, regular diet. So there's really no indication that the pace of weight loss makes a difference, but they are looking, they're doing a really interesting 3-year study right now in Australia of slow weight loss versus fat weight loss, and looking at whether or not these hormone changes, these chemical markers we talked about at the beginning of the show, if those stay compromised with slow weight loss as much as they do with fast weight loss. So we'll have more information, but it's a very good question.
We go to more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Tara Parker Pope, creator and writer of Well, which is a daily health blog, and it's also a weekly column for the New York Times. An article that she wrote, the cover story of the magazine section a week ago, was on the fat trap, looking at, many people have made resolutions to eat healthier and to lose weight. Why is it that it is so difficult? People can lose the weight, but what is it that's happening in our bodies that keeps that weight, the pounds just keep coming right on back? And what can you do about that? And do we worry too much about that? Is it okay to be slightly overweight if you're fit? Should we be concentrating more on our fitness rather than how many pounds we weigh? 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to calls, Bill in Sun Prairie. Hi.
Hello. I recently completed a dissertation on atherosclerosis, and I did a great deal of scientific research to do this over many years. I want to give you just a few comments of what my research has shown. Number one, the problem of obesity is far worse than we think. There's many health problems associated with it, and there is a term now they call diabesity that is associated, you know, it connects diabetes with obesity, and this is creating all these problems, are creating a tsunami that's going to hit our healthcare system and the costs of it. So that's one point. Second point, we're all individual chemical factories. The principle of individuality really applies with health. One size does not fit all, and there's no one explanation. Number three, I think we all agree there's a multifactorial etiology to diabetes. There's many causes, not just one, and they vary with individuals. We've talked about the hereditary aspects, the evolutionary factors, lifestyle factors. Sleep is a big one. Those people that did not get enough sleep gained weight. Certainly exercise, the quantity and quality of food. Now, there are some theories that associate who we associate with, that obesity is really kind of a contagious disease. It's a social induced disease. Now, here's where it gets interesting. There's these environmental factors that tend to be mysterious, and how we relate to them, like stress, is huge. Body image is important. But the one study that I found particularly interesting was they did experiments on animals, wild animals. They knew, you know, people were gaining weight, but they looked at animals and they found they were gaining weight, especially around urban centers. So they thought, well, maybe they're just foraging on, you know, junk food that was thrown out. So they put animals into cages, controlled their diets, and looked at them over time, and they gained weight. So my latest theories are that there's something mysterious going on besides all these other factors. It's almost as though there's some quantum entanglement or some exogenous variable in the environment. It could be EMF. It could be pollution. There is something else going on that we can't explain.
Tara?
Well, I do think it's complicated, and I don't think we fully understand how we got here. I think there are a lot of theories. It's probably not some of these, you know, people talk about food additives. They talk about, you know, plastics. I mean, there's so many theories. I think for me, writing this story, I really wanted to focus on the individual experience and what we know versus what we don't know. So what we know about weight loss, permanent weight loss, and why it's so difficult. You mentioned sleep. I think sleep is kind of an underrated health health strategy, that, you know, getting adequate sleep is a really good idea for all things related to health. And there is evidence that it can help people with weight problems as well.
Thank you, Bill, so much for your call. Tim in Colorado. Hi, Tim.
Hi. It's a very interesting discussion. I have a question for Tara, and that was, does this mean that the all these overweight children nowadays, do they face this for the rest of their life? And then the second part of the question would be, and is this a reason to monitor your kids' weight?
Well, I do think it is a good reason for people to not necessarily monitor your kids' weight, but to encourage healthy eating habits and exercise habits and set them up for a lifetime of healthy living. What we don't want to do with young children is create eating disorders. I mean, parents with children with eating disorders know the special hell that is, and I wouldn't, you know, want that life for anybody. So I think you have to be very careful with children. And the great thing about children is that if you can instill healthy eating habits, if you can focus on exercise, that even if they seem overweight or a little overweight, maybe at 8 or 9, kids sort of grow up and stretch out. And you do get a lot of kids who look a little pudgy, and parents worry at 8 or 9, maybe the pediatrician says something, and they, you know, if you get them in sports and you keep them active, especially girls, that you can sort of create a healthier child. And I think the what parents need to do is just help their children establish lifetime practices of, you know, just keep modeling for them. There are data to show that children of dieters actually eat a lot more. They binge eat, where children of people, you know, if you see your mom, especially if you're a girl, your dad if you're a boy, eating healthy, eating vegetables, not drinking soda, not eating fast food. Those are all really powerful examples you can set for your children.
Thanks, Tim, for your call. Raven in Sussex. Hi.
Hi. I've been kind of wondering about how genetics are playing a role in not only my weight, but my sister's also. Our mom, I don't remember my mom ever really being under 200 pounds. And at about 5'4", both, you know, I'm 5'4" also. My sister's about 5'6". And just wondering about, you know, at about 25, I started gaining weight, and I recently just lost 35 pounds. But, you know, do I have, in the future, am I going to be 250 pounds like my mother? And also, me and my sister,
ahead,
we tend not to eat enough. Like, it just seems like we forget to eat for some reason. We don't consciously do it. We just forget to eat somehow. You know, for some people, that's kind of impossible, but wondering how, you know, are we going to be 250 pounds possibly in the future?
Well, I think it's important to know that genetics are not destiny, and they have done some research, and there are some obesity genes that have been identified, and they have found that regular exercise is one of those sort of factors that can subvert your genetic destiny. So you may be prone to being overweight, but just because your mother was a certain weight doesn't mean that's the direction you're headed. So I think that, you know, you can, you know, if your focus is, you're going to have a lot easier time maintaining this weight where you are than you will getting to 250 and trying to get back to 200 pounds, because your body is going to eventually reset itself upward. So you're at 200 now, and there's some window that your body will accept of weight, maybe slightly lower, but you don't want to, you know, 10% weight loss is going to definitely trigger some of these biological changes based on the data that is that are available. So I would say focus on maintaining your weight and not letting yourself get to that 250. And that can be done very quickly. This whole idea of forgetting to eat, I can relate to that. I talk to a lot of people, overweight people, who forget to eat. And there is some evidence that once you're overweight, your feelings of hunger and your feelings of fullness are completely out of whack. So you don't feel hungry as quickly as maybe you ought to, and you don't feel full as quickly as maybe you ought to. So your signals are kind of messed up. So people who have maintained weight loss are pretty strict about always eating breakfast, about eating snacks at a certain time of day, and feeding themselves in a very regimented way so they don't get into these cycles of forgetting to eat and then overeating without realizing it.
And what about, you've studied all aspects of this, I'm sure, quite thoroughly. What about this idea that you should eat most of your calories just because during the course of a day we burn off a lot, that your big meals ought to be breakfast and maybe lunch and go light on dinner? Is there any truth in that?
You know, I've actually not seen any study that shows that the timing matters so much. Mm. I mean, the reason you don't want to eat too late in the day, I do think it's a good idea to, you know, eat before 8 o'clock or whatever, several hours before bedtime. And there may be some effect on digestion and you know, your body's response to food, but those kinds of little quick fixes tend not to be the issue. It tends to be, you know, are you ingesting, you know, the right amount of calories relative to your body's expenditure and your body's level of exercise? It may be it may be different from somebody else. So it's not to be judgmental and say you're overeating. You may not actually look like you're overeating. You may not be gluttonous, but you may have a body that just responds in a way that it needs, you know, it's asking for less food and more exercise.
Right. Raven, thanks for your call. Bruce in Albany. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. I have wondered if it sounds like it might be applicable here, is that different bodies respond differently. For example, I come from a big family, and everybody has commented to me, if they ate the carbs that I did, they would weigh 900 pounds. But my body seems to function well. I'm drawn to them. I like them. I eat them. And I have been able to maintain a good weight. I'm 5'11 and 175 pounds in my 50s. And people are staggered at the carbs I eat, but it does me well. I feel well, and I'm not overweight. Whereas I think others might be able to have a completely different diet, and it does them well. So it's not one diet fits all or one exercise regimen fits all.
We have about 40 seconds left, Tara.
I think that is the message, that there's widespread variation and that some people might get success on one diet while another might feel better on another. I think what's important is that we just sort of redefine what our goals are, and we appreciate the value of maintaining a healthy body weight and the value of just, you know, taking care of the body we have. And hopefully people will learn from this and be less judgmental of people who are overweight. It's difficult to be overweight, and I think we need to have more compassion and understanding for what these people are up against.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us. What an interesting article, and I know that you've been bombarded by media requests, and you fulfilled many of them to talk about this. It's a subject that is endlessly important for us.
Well, and I appreciate the interest, and it's been really great to hear from the callers and the readers and to know this has resonated, and I hope people don't give up hope, because I think just being truthful about what's going on with our bodies is the first step toward understanding it and to hopefully, you know, finding the right weight, the right, you know, life for all of us.
Hope dies last. Thank you, Tara, for being with us. Tara Parker Pope, she is a creator and writer of Well, which is the daily health blog and weekly column for the New York Times. Her piece on the fat trap appeared, let me get the right date, December 28, New York Times Sunday Magazine. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning. Thanks to Rhonda for producing the show. And thanks to Rhonda for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls. Ralph Nader is with us tomorrow. And Van Gogh, not with us, but a great book about him on Thursday.